Nothing except one old sow and her litter. I drive them into the swamp the day the Yankees come, but the Lord knows how we gwan get them. She mean that sow. We'll get them all right. You and Prissy can start right now hunting for her. Pork was amazed and indignant. Miss Carlet, that's a field hand's business. I always been a house nigger. A small fiend with a pair of hot tweezers plucked behind Scarlet's eyeballs. You two will catch the sow or get out of here like the field hands did. Tears trembled in Pork's hurt eyes. Oh, if only Miss Ellen were here. She understood such niceties and realized the wide gap between the duties of a field hand and those of a house nigger. Get out, Miss Scarlet. Well, I get out too, Miss Scarlet. I don't know and I don't care. But anyone at Terra who won't work can go hunt up the Yankees. You can tell the others that too.
Yes'm.
Now what about the corn and the cotton, Pork?
The corn? Lord, Miss Scarlet, de pastured the horses in the corn, and carried off what the horses didn't eat or spell. And they drive the cannons and wagons across the cotton till it plumb ruined, except a few acres over on the creek bottom that they didn't notice. But that cotton ain't worth fooling with, 'cause ain't but about 3 bales over there.
3 bales? Scarlet thought of the scores of bales Tara usually yielded, and her head hurt worse. 3 bales? That was little more than a shiftless slattery's raised. To make matters worse, there was the question of taxes. The Confederate government took cotton for taxes in lieu of money, but 3 bales wouldn't even cover the taxes. Little did it matter, though. To her or the Confederacy, now that all the field hands had run away and there was no one to pick the cotton. Well, I won't think of that either, she told herself. Taxes aren't a woman's job anyway. Pa ought to look after such things, but Pa... I won't think of Pa now. The Confederacy can whistle for its taxes. What we need now is something to eat. Pork, have any of you been to 12 Oaks or the McIntosh place to see if there's anything left in the gardens there?
No, ma'am. Us ain't left Tara. The Yankees might get us.
I'll send Dilsey over to McIntosh. Perhaps she'll find something there. And I'll go to 12 Oaks.
Who would, child?
By myself. Mammy must stay with the girls, and Mr. Gerald can't... Pork set up an outcry which she found infuriating. There might be Yankees or mean niggers at 12 Oaks. She mustn't go alone. That will be enough, Pork. Tell Dilsey to start immediately. And you and Prissy go bring in the sow and her litter, she said briefly, turning on her heel. Mammy's old sunbonnet, faded but clean, hung on its peg on the back porch, and Scarlet put it on her head, remembering, as from another world, the bonnet with a curling green plume which Rhett had brought her from Paris. She picked up a large split-oak basket and started down the back stairs, each step jouncing her head until her spine seemed to be trying to crash through the top of her skull. The road down to the river lay red and scorching between the ruined cotton fields. There were no trees to cast a shade, and the sun beat down through Mammy's sunbonnet as if it were made of tarlatan instead of heavy quilted calico, while the dust floating upward sifted into her nose and throat until she felt the membranes would crack dryly if she spoke. Deep ruts and furrows were cut into the road where the horses had dragged heavy guns along it, and the red gullies on either side were deeply gashed by the wheels. The cotton was mangled and trampled where cavalry and infantry, forced off the narrow road by the artillery, had marched through the green bushes, grinding them into the earth. Here and there in the road and fields lay buckles and bits of harness leather, canteens flattened by hooves and caisson wheels, buttons, blue caps, worn socks, bits of bloody rags, all the litter left by a marching army. She passed the clump of cedars and the low brick wall which marked the family burying ground, trying not to think of the new grave lying by the 3 short mounds of her little brothers. Oh, Ellen! She trudged on down the dusty hill, passing the heap of ashes and the stumpy chimney where the Slattery house had stood. And she wished savagely that the whole tribe of them had been part of the ashes. If it hadn't been for the Slatteries, if it hadn't been for that nasty Emmy, who'd had a bastard brat by their overseer, Ellen wouldn't have died. She moaned as a sharp pebble cut into her blistered foot. What was she doing here? Why was Scarlett O'Hara, the belle of the county, the sheltered pride of Tara, tramping down this rough road almost barefoot? Her little feet were made to dance, not to limp. Her tiny slippers to peep daringly from under bright silks, not to collect sharp pebbles and dust. She was born to be pampered and waited upon, and here she was, sick and ragged, driven by hunger to hunt for food in the gardens of her neighbors. At the bottom of the long hill was the river, and how cool and still were the tangled trees overhanging the water. She sank down on the low bank, and stripping off the remnants of her slippers and stockings, dabbled her burning feet in the cool water. It would be so good to sit here all day, away from the helpless eyes of Tara, here where only the rustle of leaves and the gurgle of slow water broke the stillness. But reluctantly, she replaced her shoes and stockings and trudged down the bank, spongy with moss, under the shady trees. The Yankees had burned the bridge, but she knew of a footlog bridge across a narrow point of the stream 100 yards below. She crossed it cautiously and trudged uphill the hot half-mile to 12 Oaks. There towered the 12 Oaks, as they had stood since Indian days, but with their leaves brown from fire, and the branches burned and scorched. Within their circle lay the ruins of John Wilkes' house, the charred remains of that once stately home which had crowned the hill in white-columned dignity. The deep pit which had been the cellar, the blackened fieldstone foundations, and the two mighty chimneys marked the site. One long column, half-burned, had fallen across the lawn, crushing the Cape jessamine bushes. Scarlett sat down on the column, too sick at the sight to go on. This desolation went to her heart as nothing she had ever experienced. Here was the Wilkes pride in the dust at her feet. Here was the end of the kindly, courteous house, which had always welcomed her. The house where, in futile dreams, she had aspired to be mistress. Here she had danced and dined and flirted, and here she had watched with a jealous, hurting heart how Melanie smiled up at Ashley. Here, too, in the cool shadows of the trees, Charles Hamilton had rapturously pressed her hand when she said she would marry him. "Oh, Ashley," she thought, "I hope you're dead. I could never bear for you to see this." Ashley had married his bride here, but his son and his son's son would never bring brides to this house. There would be no more matings and births beneath this roof, which she had so loved and longed to rule. The house was dead, and to Scarlett, it was as if all the Wilkeses, too, were dead in its ashes. "I won't think of it now. I can't stand it now. I'll think of it later," she said aloud, turning her eyes away. Seeking the garden, she limped around the ruins, by the trampled rose beds the Wilkes girls had tended so zealously, across the backyard and through the ashes of the smokehouse, barns and chicken houses. The split-rail fence around the kitchen garden had been demolished, and the once orderly rows of green plants had suffered the same treatment as those at Tara. The soft earth was scarred with hoofprints and heavy wheels, and the vegetables were mashed into the soil. There was nothing for her here. She walked back across the yard, and took the path down toward the silent row of whitewashed cabins in the quarters, calling, "Hello!" as she went. But no voice answered her. Not even a dog barked. Evidently the Wilkes Negroes had taken flight or followed the Yankees. She knew every slave had his own garden patch, and as she reached the quarters, She hoped these little patches had been spared. Her search was rewarded, but she was too tired even to feel pleasure at the sight of turnips and cabbages, wilted for want of water but still standing, and straggling butter beans and snap beans, yellow but edible. She sat down in the furrows and dug into the earth with hands that shook, filling her basket slowly. There would be a good meal at Terra tonight, in spite of the lack of side meat to boil with the vegetables. Perhaps some of the bacon grease Dilsey was using for illumination could be used for seasoning. She must remember to tell Dilsey to use pine knots and save the grease for cooking. Close to the back step of one cabin, she found a short row of radishes, and hunger assaulted her suddenly. A spicy, sharp-tasting radish was exactly what her stomach craved. Hardly waiting to rub the dirt off on her skirt, she bit off half and swallowed it hastily. It was old and coarse, and so peppery that tears started in her eyes. No sooner had the lump gone down than her empty, outraged stomach revolted, and she lay in the soft dirt and vomited tiredly. The faint, niggery smell which crept from the cabin increased her nausea, and without strength to combat it, she kept on retching miserably while the cabins and trees revolved swiftly around her. After a long time, she lay weakly on her face, the earth as soft and comfortable as a feather pillow, and her mind wandered feebly here and there. She, Scarlett O'Hara, was lying behind a Negro cabin, in the midst of ruins, too sick and too weak to move. And no one in the world knew or cared. No one would care if they did know. For everyone had too many troubles of their own to worry about her. And all this was happening to her, Scarlett O'Hara, who had never raised her hand even to pick up her discarded stockings from the floor or to tie the laces of her slippers. Scarlett, whose little headaches and tempers had been coddled and catered to all her life. As she lay prostrate, too weak to fight off memories and worries, they rushed at her, circled about her like buzzards waiting for a death. No longer had she the strength to say, "I'll think of Mother and Pa and Ashley and all this ruin later. Yes, later, when I can stand it." She could not stand it now. But she was thinking of them, whether she willed it or not. The thought circled and swooped above her, dived down and drove tearing claws and sharp beaks into her mind. For a timeless time, she lay still, her face in the dirt, the sun beating hotly upon her, remembering things and people who were dead, remembering a way of living that was gone forever, and looking upon the harsh vista of the dark future. When she arose at last and saw again the black ruins of Twelve Oaks, her head was raised high, and something that was youth and beauty and potential tenderness had gone out of her face forever. What was past was past. Those who were dead were dead. The lazy luxury of the old days was gone, never to return. And as Scarlett settled the heavy basket across her arm, she had settled her own mind and her own life. There was no going back, and she was going forward. Throughout the South for 50 years, there would be bitter-eyed women who looked backward, to dead times, to dead men, evoking memories that hurt and were futile, bearing poverty with bitter pride because they had those memories. But Scarlett was never to look back. She gazed at the blackened stones, and for the last time she saw Twelve Oaks rise before her eyes as it had once stood, rich and proud, symbol of a race and a way of living. Then she started down the road toward Terra, the heavy basket cutting into her flesh. Hunger gnawed at her empty stomach again, and she said aloud, "As God is my witness, as God is my witness, the Yankees aren't going to lick me. I'm going to live through this, and when it's over, I'm never going to be hungry again. No, nor any of my folks. If I have to steal or kill, as God is my witness, I am never going to be hungry again. In the days that followed, Tara might have been Crusoe's desert island, so still it was, so isolated from the rest of the world. The world lay only a few miles away, but 1,000 miles of tumbling waves might have stretched between Tara and Jonesboro and Fayetteville and Lovejoy, even between Tara and the neighbor's plantations. With the old horse dead, their one mode of conveyance was gone, and there was neither time nor strength for walking the weary red miles. Sometimes in the days of back-breaking work, in the desperate struggle for food, and the never-ceasing care of the 3 sick girls, Scarlet found herself straining her ears for familiar sounds. The shrill laughter of the pickaninnies in the quarters, the creaking of wagons home from the fields, the thunder of Gerald's stallion tearing across the pasture, the crunching of carriage wheels on the drive, and the gay voices of neighbors dropping in for an afternoon of gossip. But she listened in vain. The road lay still and deserted, and never a cloud of red dust proclaimed the approach of visitors. Tara was an island in a sea of rolling green hills and red fields. Somewhere was the world and families who ate and slept safely under their own roofs. Somewhere girls in thrice-turned dresses were flirting gaily and singing, "When this cruel war is over," as she had done only a few weeks before. Somewhere there was a war and cannon booming and burning towns and men who rotted in hospitals amid sickening sweet stinks. Somewhere a barefoot army in dirty homespun was marching, fighting, sleeping, hungry, and weary with the weariness that comes when hope is gone. And somewhere the hills of Georgia were blue with Yankees, well-fed Yankees on sleek corn-stuffed horses. Beyond Tara was the war and the world. But on the plantation, the war and the world did not exist, except as memories, which must be fought back when they rushed to mind in moments of exhaustion. The world outside receded before the demands of empty and half-empty stomachs, and life resolved itself into 2 related thoughts, food and how to get it. Food. Food. Why did the stomach have a longer memory than the mind? Scarlet could banish heartbreak, but not hunger, and each morning as she lay half asleep, before memory brought back to her mind war and hunger, she curled drowsily, expecting the sweet smells of bacon frying and rolls baking. And each morning she sniffed so hard to really smell the food, she woke herself up. There were apples, yams, peanuts, and milk on the table at Tara, but never enough of even this primitive fare. At the sight of them, 3 times a day, her memory would rush back to the old days, the meals of the old days, the candlelit table and the food perfuming the air. How careless they had been of food then! What prodigal waste! Rolls, corn muffins, biscuits and waffles, dripping butter, all at one meal. Ham at one end of the table, and fried chicken at the other. Collards swimming richly in pot liquor, iridescent with grease. Snap beans in mountains on brightly flowered porcelain. Fried squash, stewed okra, carrots in cream sauce, thick enough to cut. And 3 desserts, so everyone might have his choice. Chocolate layer cake, vanilla blancmange, and pound cake topped with sweet whipped cream. The memory of those savory meals had the power to bring tears to her eyes, as death and war had failed to do, had the power to turn her ever-gnawing stomach from rumbling emptiness to nausea. For the appetite Mammy had always deplored, the healthy appetite of a 19-year-old girl, now was increased 4-fold by the hard and unremitting labor she had never known before. Hers was not the only troublesome appetite at Tara, for wherever she turned, hungry faces, black and white, met her eyes. Soon Corrine and Sue Ellen would have the insatiable hunger of typhoid convalescents. Already little Wade whined monotonously.
Wade don't like yams. Wade hungry.
The others grumbled too.
Miss Scarlet, unless I gets more to eat, I can't nurse neither of these children.
Miss Scarlet,
if I don't have more in my stomach, I can't split no wood.
Lamb, I's perishing for real vittles.
Daughter, must we always have yams?
Only Melanie did not complain. Melanie, whose face grew thinner and whiter and twitched with pain even in her sleep.
I'm not hungry, Scarlet. Give my share of the milk to Dilsey. She needs it to nurse the babies. Sick people are never hungry.
It was her gentle hardihood which irritated Scarlet more than the nagging, whining voices of the others. She could, and did, shout them down with bitter sarcasm, but before Melanie's unselfishness, she was helpless. Helpless and resentful. Gerald, the Negroes, and Wade clung to Melanie now, because even in her weakness she was kind and sympathetic. And these days Scarlet was neither. Wade especially haunted Melanie's room. There was something wrong with Wade, but just what it was Scarlet had no time to discover. She took Mammy's word that the little boy had worms and dosed him with a mixture of dried herbs and bark, which Ellen always used to worm the pickaninnies. But the vermifuge only made the child look paler. These days Scarlet hardly thought of Wade as a person. He was only another worry, another mouth to feed. Some day, when the present emergency was over, she would play with him, tell him stories, and teach him his ABCs. But now she didn't have the time or the inclination. And because he always seemed underfoot when she was most weary and worried, she often spoke sharply to him. It annoyed her that her quick reprimands brought such acute fright to his round eyes, for he looked so simple-minded when he was frightened. She didn't realize that the little boy lived shoulder to shoulder with terror too great for an adult to comprehend. Fear lived with Wade. Fear that shook his soul and made him wake screaming in the night. Any unexpected noise or sharp words set him to trembling. For in his mind, noises and harsh words were inextricably mixed with Yankees, and he was more afraid of Yankees than of Prissy's haunts. Until the thunders of the siege began, he had never known anything but a happy, placid, quiet life. Even though his mother paid him little attention, he had known nothing but petting and kind words until the night when he was jerked from slumber to find the sky aflame and the air deafening with explosions. In that night, and the day which followed, he had been slapped by his mother for the first time, and had heard her voice raised at him in harsh words. Life in the pleasant brick house on Peachtree Street, the only life he knew, had vanished that night, and he would never recover from its loss. In the flight from Atlanta, he had understood nothing except that the Yankees were after him, and now he still lived in fear that the Yankees would catch him and cut him to pieces. Whenever Scarlet raised her voice in reproof, he went weak with fright, as his vague childish memory brought up the horrors of the first time she had ever done it. Now, Yankees and a cross voice were linked forever in his mind, and he was afraid of his mother. Scarlet could not help noticing that the child was beginning to avoid her, and in the rare moments when her unending duties gave her time to think about it, it bothered her a great deal. It was even worse than having him at her skirts all the time, and she was offended that his refuge was Melanie's bed, where he played quietly at games Melanie suggested or listened to stories she told. Wade adored Auntie, who had a gentle voice,
and who always smiled, and who never said, "Hush, Wade, you give me a headache," or, "Stop fidgeting, Wade, for heaven's sake." Scarlet had neither the time nor the impulse to pet him, but it made her jealous to see Melanie do it. When she found him one day standing on his head in Melanie's bed and saw him collapse on her, she slapped him. "Don't you know better than to jiggle Auntie like that when she's sick? Now trot right out in the yard and play, and don't come in here again." But Melanie reached out a weak arm and drew the wailing child to her. "There, there, Wade. You didn't mean to jiggle me, did you?" "He doesn't bother me, Scarlet. Do let him stay with me. Let me take care of him. It's the only thing I can do till I get well. And you've your hands full enough without having to watch him." "Don't be a goose, Melly," said Scarlet shortly. "You aren't getting well like you should. And having Wade fall on your stomach won't help you. Now, Wade, if I ever catch you on Auntie's bed again, I'll wear you out. And stop sniffling. You're always sniffling. Try to be a little man." Wade flew, sobbing, to hide himself under the house. Melanie bit her lip and tears came to her eyes. And Mammy, standing in the hall, a witness to the scene, scowled and breathed hard. But no one talked back to Scarlet these days. They were all afraid of her sharp tongue. All afraid of the new person who walked in her body. Scarlet reigned supreme at Terra now, and, like others suddenly elevated to authority, all the bullying instincts in her nature rose to the surface. It wasn't that she was basically unkind. It was because she was so frightened and unsure of herself she was harsh, lest others learn her inadequacies and refuse her authority. Besides, there was some pleasure in shouting at people and knowing they were afraid. Scarlet found that it relieved her overwrought nerves. She wasn't blind to the fact that her personality was changing. Sometimes when her curt orders made Pork stick out his underlip and Mammy mutter, "Some folks rides mighty high these days," she wondered where her good manners had gone. All the courtesy, all the gentleness Ellen had striven to instill in her had fallen away from her as quickly as leaves fall from trees in the first chill wind of autumn. Time and again Ellen had said, "Be firm but gentle with inferiors, especially darkies." But if she was gentle, the darkies would sit in the kitchen all day, talking endlessly about the good old days, when a house nigger wasn't supposed to do field hands work. "Love and cherish your sisters. Be kind to the afflicted," said Ellen. "Show tenderness to those in sorrow and in trouble." She couldn't love her sisters now. They were simply a dead weight on her shoulders. And as for cherishing them, wasn't she bathing them, combing their hair and feeding them, even at the expense of walking miles every day to find vegetables? Wasn't she learning to milk the cow, even though her heart was always in her throat when that fearsome animal shook its horns at her? And as for being kind, that was a waste of time. If she was overly kind to them, they'd probably prolong their stay in bed. And she wanted them on their feet again as soon as possible, so there would be four more hands to help her. They were convalescing slowly, and lay scrawny and weak in their bed. While they had been unconscious, the world had changed. The Yankees had come, the darkies had gone, and Mother had died. Here were three unbelievable happenings, and their minds could not take them in. Sometimes they believed they must still be delirious, and these things had not happened at all. Certainly Scarlet was so changed she couldn't be real. When she hung over the foot of their bed and outlined the work she expected them to do when they recovered, they looked at her as if she were a hobgoblin. It was beyond their comprehension that they no longer had 100 slaves to do the work. It was beyond their comprehension that an O'Hara lady should do manual labor. "But sister," said Corrine, her sweet childish face blank with consternation, I couldn't split kindling. It would ruin my hands.
Look at mine, answered Scarlet with a frightening smile as she pushed blistered and calloused palms toward her.
I think you are hateful to talk to Baby and me like this, cried Sue Ellen. I think you are lying and trying to frighten us. If Mother were only here, she wouldn't let you talk to us like this. Split kindling, indeed!
Sue Ellen looked with weak loathing at her older sister, feeling sure Scarlet said these things just to be mean. Sue Ellen had nearly died, and she had lost her mother, and she was lonely and scared, and she wanted to be petted and made much of. Instead, Scarlet looked over the foot of the bed each day, appraising their improvement with a hateful new gleam in her slanting green eyes, and talked about making beds, preparing food, carrying water buckets and splitting kindling. And she looked as if she took a pleasure in saying such awful things. Scarlet did take pleasure in it. She bullied the Negroes and harrowed the feelings of her sisters not only because she was too worried and strained and tired to do otherwise, but because it helped her to forget her own bitterness that everything her mother had told her about life was wrong. Nothing her mother had taught her was of any value whatsoever now, and Scarlet's heart was sore and puzzled. It didn't occur to her that Ellen could not have foreseen the collapse of the civilization in which she raised her daughters, could not have anticipated the disappearing of the places in society for which she trained them so well. It did not occur to her that Ellen had looked down a vista of placid future years, all like the uneventful years of her own life, when she had taught her to be gentle and gracious, honorable and kind, modest and truthful. Life treated women well when they had learned those lessons, said Ellen. Scarlet thought in despair.
Nothing. No, nothing she taught me is of any help to me. What good will kindness do me now? What value is gentleness? Better that I'd learned to plow or chop cotton like a darky. Oh, Mother, you were wrong.
She didn't stop to think that Ellen's ordered world was gone, and a brutal world had taken its place. A world wherein every standard, every value had changed. She only saw, or thought she saw, that her mother had been wrong, and she changed swiftly to meet this new world for which she was not prepared. Only her feeling for Tara had not changed. She never came wearily home across the fields and saw the sprawling white house, that her heart didn't swell with love and the joy of homecoming. She never looked out of a window at green pastures and red fields and tall, tangled swamp forest, that a sense of beauty didn't fill her. Her love for this land with its softly rolling hills of bright red soil, this beautiful red earth that was blood-colored, garnet, brick dust, vermilion, which so miraculously grew green bushes starred with white puffs, was one part of Scarlet which didn't change when all else was changing. Nowhere else in the world was there land like this. When she looked at Tara, she could understand, in part, why wars were fought. Rhett was wrong when he said men fought wars for money. No, they fought for swelling acres, softly furrowed by the plow, for pastures green with stubby cropped grass, for lazy yellow rivers and white houses that were cool amid magnolias. These were the only things worth fighting for, the red earth which was theirs and would be their sons, the red earth which would bear cotton for their sons and their sons' sons. The trampled acres of Tara were all that was left to her, now that Mother and Ashley were gone, now that Gerald was senile from shock, and money and darkies and security and position had vanished overnight. And from another world, she remembered a conversation with her father about the land, and wondered how she could have been so young, so ignorant, as not to understand what he meant when he said that the land was the one thing in the world worth fighting for. For 'tis the only thing in the world that lasts. And to anyone with a drop of Irish blood in them, the land they live on is like their mother. 'Tis the only thing worth working for, fighting for, dying for. Yes, Tara was worth fighting for. And she accepted simply and without question the fight. No one was going to get Tara away from her. No one was going to set her and her people adrift on the charity of relatives. She would hold Tara, if she had to break the back of every person on it. Chapter 26. Scarlet had been at Tara 2 weeks since her return from Atlanta, when the largest blister on her foot began to fester, swelling until it was impossible for her to put on her shoe or do more than hobble about on her heel. Desperation plucked at her when she looked at the angry sore on her toe. Suppose it should gangrene like the soldier's wounds and she should die, far away from a doctor. Bitter as life was now, she had no desire to leave it. And who would look after Tara if she should die? She had hoped when she first came home that Gerald's old spirit would revive, and he would take command. But in these 2 weeks that hope had vanished. She knew now that whether she liked it or not, she had the plantation and all its people on her 2 inexperienced hands, for Gerald still sat quietly like a man in a dream, so frighteningly absent from Tara, so gentle. To her pleas for advice he gave as his only answer, "Do what you think best, daughter. Or worse still, consult with your mother, puss." He would never be any different, and now Scarlet realized the truth and accepted it without emotion. That until he died, Gerald would always be waiting for Ellen, always listening for her. He was in some dim borderline country where time was standing still, and Ellen was always in the next room. The mainspring of his existence was taken away from him when she died, and with it had gone his bounding assurance, his impudence, and his restless vitality. Ellen was the audience before which the blustering drama of Gerald O'Hara had been played. Now the curtain had been rung down forever, the footlights dimmed, and the audience suddenly vanished, while the stunned old actor remained on his empty stage, waiting for his cues. That morning the house was still, for everyone, except Scarlet, Wade, and the 3 sick girls, was in the swamp hunting the sow. Even Gerald had aroused a little and stumped off across the furrowed fields, one hand on Pork's arm and a coil of rope in the other. Sue Ellen and Corrine had cried themselves to sleep, as they did at least twice a day when they thought of Ellen, tears of grief and weakness oozing down their sunken cheeks. Melanie, who had been propped up on pillows for the first time that day, lay covered with a mended sheet between 2 babies. The downy flaxen head of one cuddled in her arm, the kinky black head of Dilsey's child held as gently in the other. Wade sat at the bottom of the bed, listening to a fairy story. To Scarlet, the stillness at Tara was unbearable, for it reminded her too sharply of the death-like stillness of the desolate country through which she had passed that long day on her way home from Atlanta. The cow and the calf had made no sound for hours. There were no birds twittering outside her window, and even the noisy family of mawkers who had lived among the harshly rustling leaves of the magnolia for generations had no song that day. She had drawn a low chair close to the open window of her bedroom, looking out on the front drive, the lawn and the empty green pasture across the road, and she sat with her skirts well above her knees and her chin resting on her arms on the window sill. There was a bucket of well water on the floor beside her, and every now and then she lowered her blistered foot into it, screwing up her face at the stinging sensation. Fretting, she dug her chin into her arm. Just when she needed her strength most, this toe had to fester. Those fools would never catch the sow. It had taken them a week to capture the pigs one by one, and now, after 2 weeks, the sow was still at liberty. Scarlet knew that if she were just there in the swamp with them, she could tuck up her dress to her knees and take the rope and lasso the sow before you could say, "Jack Robinson." But even after the sow was caught, if she were caught, what then, after she and her litter were eaten? Life would go on, and so would appetites. Winter was coming, and there would be no food. Not even the poor remnants of the vegetables from the neighbors' gardens. They must have dried peas and sorghum and meal and rice and so many things. Corn and cottonseed for next spring's planting. And new clothes, too. Where was it all to come from, and how would she pay for it? She had privately gone through Gerald's pockets and his cash box, and all she could find was stacks of Confederate bonds and $3,000 in Confederate bills. That was about enough to buy one square meal for them all, she thought ironically, now that Confederate money was worth almost less than nothing at all. But if she did have money and could find food, how would she haul it home to Tara? Why had God let the old horse die? Even that sorry animal Rhett had stolen would make all the difference in the world to them. Oh, those fine, sleek mules which used to kick up their heels in the pasture across the road, and the handsome carriage horses, her little mare, the girl's ponies, and Gerald's big stallion racing about and tearing up the turf. Oh, for one of them, even the bulkiest mule. But no matter. When her foot healed, she would walk to Jonesboro. It would be the longest walk she had ever taken in her life, but walk it she would. Even if the Yankees had burned the town completely, she would certainly find someone in the neighborhood who could tell her where to get food. Wade's pinched face rose up before her eyes. He didn't like yams, he repeated. Wanted a drumstick and some rice and gravy. The bright sunlight in the front yard suddenly clouded, and the trees blurred through tears. Scarlet dropped her head on her arms and struggled not to cry. Crying was so useless now. The only time crying ever did any good was when there was a man around from whom you wished favors. As she crouched there, squeezing her eyes tightly to keep back the tears, she was startled by the sound of trotting hooves. But she didn't raise her head. She had imagined that sound too often in the nights and days of these last 2 weeks, just as she had imagined she heard the rustle of Ellen's skirts. Her heart hammered, as it always did at such moments, before she told herself sternly, "Don't be a fool." But the hooves slowed down in a startlingly natural way to the rhythm of a walk, and there was the measured scrunch-scrunch on the gravel. It was a horse. The Tarletons, the Fontaines. She looked up quickly. It was a Yankee cavalryman. Automatically, she dodged behind the curtain and peered fascinated at him through the dim folds of the cloth, so startled that the breath went out of her lungs with a gasp. He sat slouched in the saddle, a thick, rough-looking man with an unkempt black beard straggling over his unbuttoned blue jacket. Little close-set eyes squinting in the sun glare. Calmly surveyed the house from beneath the visor of his tight blue cap. As he slowly dismounted and tossed the bridle reins over the hitching post, Scarlet's breath came back to her suddenly and painfully as after a blow in the stomach. A Yankee! A Yankee with a long pistol on his hip. And she was alone in the house with three sick girls and the babies. As he lounged up the walk, hand on holster, beady little eyes glancing to right and left,
A kaleidoscope of jumbled pictures spun in her mind. Stories Aunt Pittypat had whispered of attacks on unprotected women. Throat cuttings. Houses burned over the heads of dying women. Children bayoneted because they cried. All of the unspeakable horrors that lay bound up in the name of Yankee. Her first terrified impulse was to hide in the closet, crawl under the bed, fly down the back stairs and run screaming to the swamp, anything to escape him. Then she heard his cautious feet on the front steps, and his stealthy tread as he entered the hall, and she knew that escape was cut off. Too cold with fear to move. She heard his progress from room to room downstairs, his steps growing louder and bolder as he discovered no one. Now he was in the dining room, and in a moment he would walk out into the kitchen. At the thought of the kitchen, rage suddenly leaped up in Scarlet's breast, so sharply that it jabbed at her heart like a knife thrust, and fear fell away before her overpowering fury. The kitchen! There, over the open kitchen fire, were two pots, one filled with apple stewing and the other with a hodgepodge of vegetables brought painfully from Twelve Oaks in the McIntosh garden. Dinner that must serve for 9 hungry people, and hardly enough for 2. Scarlet had been restraining her appetite for hours, waiting for the return of the others, and the thought of the Yankee eating their meager meal made her shake with anger. God damn them all! They descended like locusts and left Terra to starve slowly, and now they were back again to steal the poor leavings. Her empty stomach writhed within her. By God, this was one Yankee who would do no more stealing. She slipped off her worn shoe, and barefooted, she pattered swiftly to the bureau, not even feeling a festered toe. She opened the top drawer soundlessly and caught up the heavy pistol she had brought from Atlanta, the weapon Charles had worn but never fired. She fumbled in the leather box that hung on the wall below his saber and brought out a cap. She slipped it into place with a hand that did not shake. Quickly and noiselessly, she ran into the upper hall and down the stairs, steadying herself on the banisters with one hand and holding the pistol close to her thigh in the folds of her skirt. "Who's there?" cried a nasal voice, and she stopped on the middle of the stairs, the blood thudding in her ears so loudly she could hardly hear him. "Halt, or I'll shoot," came the voice. He stood in the door of the dining room, crouched tensely, his pistol in one hand, and in the other, the small rosewood sewing box fitted with gold thimble, gold-handled scissors, and tiny gold-topped acorn of emery. Scarlet's legs felt cold to the knees, but rage scorched her face. Ellen's sewing box in his hands! She wanted to cry. "Put it down! Put it down, you dirty—" But words would not come. She could only stare over the banisters at him, and watch his face change from harsh tenseness to a half-contemptuous, half-ingratiating smile. "So there is somebody to home," he said, slipping his pistol back into its holster and moving into the hall until he stood directly below her.
"All alone, little lady?"
Like lightning, she shoved her weapon over the banisters and into the startled, bearded face. Before he could even fumble at his belt, she pulled the trigger. The back kick of the pistol made her reel as the roar of the explosion filled her ears and the acrid smoke stung her nostrils. The man crashed backwards to the floor, sprawling into the dining room with a violence that shook the furniture. The box clattered from his hand, the contents spilling about him. Hardly aware that she was moving, Scarlet ran down the stairs and stood over him, gazing down into what was left of the face above the beard, a bloody pit where the nose had been, glazing eyes burned with powder. As she looked, 2 streams of blood crept across the shining floor, one from his face and one from the back of his head. Yes, he was dead, undoubtedly. She had killed the man. The smoke curled slowly to the ceiling, and the red streams widened about her feet. For a timeless moment, she stood there. And in the still hot hush of the summer morning, every irrelevant sound and scent seemed magnified. The quick thudding of her heart, like a drumbeat, the slight rough rustling of the magnolia leaves, the far-off plaintive sound of a swamp bird, and the sweet smell of the flowers outside the window. She had killed a man. She who took care never to be in at the kill on a hunt. She who could not bear the squealing of a hog at slaughter, or the squeak of a rabbit in a snare. Murder, she thought dully. I've done murder. Oh, this can't be happening to me. Her eyes went to the stubby, hairy hand on the floor, so close to the sewing box. And suddenly she was vitally alive again. Vitally glad, with a cool, tigerish joy. She could have ground her heel into the gaping wound which had been his nose, and taken sweet pleasure in the feel of his warm blood on her bare feet. She had struck a blow of revenge for Tara, and for Ellen. There were hurried, stumbling steps in the upper hall, a pause, and then more steps. Weak, dragging steps now, punctuated by metallic clankings. A sense of time and reality coming back to her, Scarlet looked up and saw Melanie at the top of the stairs, clad only in the ragged chemise, which served her as a nightgown, her weak arm weighed down with Charles's saber. Melanie's eyes took in the scene below in its entirety, the sprawling blue-clad body in the red pool, the sewing box beside him, Scarlet, barefooted and gray-faced, clutching the long pistol. In silence, her eyes met Scarlet's. There was a glow of grim pride in her usually gentle face. Approbation and a fierce joy in her smile that equaled the fiery tumult in Scarlet's own bosom. Why, she's like me. She understands how I feel, thought Scarlet, in that long moment. She'd have done the same thing. With a thrill, she looked up at the frail, swaying girl for whom she had never had any feelings but of dislike and contempt. Now, struggling against hatred for Ashley's wife, there surged a feeling of admiration and comradeship. She saw in a flash of clarity untouched by any petty emotion that beneath the gentle voice and the dove-like eyes of Melanie there was a thin, flashing blade of unbreakable steel. Felt, too, that there were banners and bugles of courage in Melanie's quiet blood. "Scarlet! Scarlet!" shrilled the weak, frightened voices of Sue Ellen and Corrine, muffled by their closed door. And Wade's voice screamed, "Auntie! Auntie!" Swiftly, Melanie put her finger to her lips, and, laying the sword on the top step, she painfully made her way down the upstairs hall and opened the door of the sick room. "Don't be scared, chickens," came her voice with teasing gaiety. "Your big sister was trying to clean the rust off Charles's pistol, and it went off, and nearly scared her to death. Now wait, Hampton. Mama just shot off your dear papa's pistol. When you're bigger, she will let you shoot it." What a cool liar, thought Scarlet with admiration. I couldn't have thought that quickly. But why lie? They've got to know I've done it. She looked down at the body again, and now revulsion came over her, as her rage and fright melted away, and her knees began to quiver with the reaction. Melanie dragged herself to the top step again and started down, holding onto the banisters, her pale lower lip caught between her teeth. "Go back to bed, silly. You'll kill yourself," Scarlet cried. But the half-naked Melanie made her painful way down into the lower hall. "Scarlet," she whispered, "we must get him out of here and bury him. He may not be alone, and if they find him here..." She steadied herself on Scarlet's arm.
"He must be alone," said Scarlet. "I didn't see anyone else from the upstairs window. He must be a deserter." "Even if he is alone, no one must know about it. The Negroes might talk, and then they'd come and get you. Scarlet, we must get him hidden before the folks come back from the swamp." Her mind prodded to action by the feverish urgency of Melanie's voice. Scarlet thought hard. "I could bury him in the corner of the garden under the arbor. The ground is soft there where Pork dug up the whiskey barrel. But how will I get him there?" "We'll both take a leg and drag him," said Melanie firmly. Reluctantly, Scarlet's admiration went still higher. "You couldn't drag a cat." "I'll drag him," she said roughly. "You go back to bed. You'll kill yourself. Don't dare try to help me either, or I'll carry you upstairs myself." Melanie's white face broke into a sweet, understanding smile. "You are very dear, Scarlet," she said, and softly brushed her lips against Scarlet's cheek. Before Scarlet could recover from her surprise, Melanie went on. "If you drag him out, I'll mop up the mess before the folks get home, and, Scarlet..."
"Yes?"
"Do you suppose it would be dishonest to go through his knapsack? He might have something to eat."
"I do not," said Scarlet, annoyed that she hadn't thought of this herself. "You take the knapsack, and I'll go through his pockets."
Stooping over the dead man with distaste, she unbuttoned the remaining buttons of his jacket and systematically began rifling his pockets.
"Dear God," she whispered, pulling out a bulging wallet wrapped about with a rag. Melanie, I think it's full of money."
Melanie said nothing but abruptly sat down on the floor and leaned back against the wall.
"You look," she said shakily. "I'm feeling a little weak."
Scarlet tore off the rag and with trembling hands opened the leather folds.
"Look, Millie, just look."
Melanie looked and her eyes dilated. Jumbled together was a mass of bills, United States greenbacks, mingling with Confederate money, and glinting from between them were one $10 gold piece and two $5 gold pieces.
"Don't stop to count it now," said Melanie, as Scarlet began fingering the bills. "We haven't time." "Do you realize, Melanie, that this money means that we'll eat?"
"Yes, yes, dear. I know, but we haven't time now. You look in his other pockets, and I'll take the knapsack."
Scarlet was loath to put down the wallet. Bright vistas opened before her. Real money. The Yankee's horse. Food. There was a God after all. And he did provide, even if he did take very odd ways of providing. She sat on her haunches and stared at the wallet, smiling. Food. Melanie plucked it from her hands. "Hurry," she said. The trouser pockets yielded nothing except a candle end, a jackknife, and a plug of tobacco and a bit of twine. Melanie removed from a knapsack a small package of coffee, which she sniffed as if it were the sweetest of perfumes. Hardtack, and her face changing, a miniature of a little girl in a gold frame set with seed pearls, a garnet brooch, two broad gold bracelets with tiny dangling gold chains, a gold thimble, a small silver baby's cup, gold embroidery scissors, a diamond solitaire ring, and a pair of earrings with pendant pear-shaped diamonds, which even their unpracticed eyes could tell were well over a carat each.
"A thief!" whispered Melanie, recoiling from the still body. "Scarlet! He must have stolen all of this."
"Of course," said Scarlet. "And he came here hoping to steal more from us."
"I'm glad you killed him," said Melanie, her gentle eyes hard. "Now hurry, darling, and get him out of here."
Scarlet bent over, caught the dead man by his boots and tugged. How heavy he was, and how weak she suddenly felt. Suppose she shouldn't be able to move him. Turning so that she backed the corpse, she caught a heavy boot under each arm and threw her weight forward. He moved, and she jerked again. Her sore foot, forgotten in the excitement, now gave a tremendous throb that made her grit her teeth and shift her weight to the heel. Tugging and straining, perspiration dripping from her forehead, she dragged him down the hall, a red stain following her path.
"If he bleeds across the yard, we can't hide it," she gasped. "Give me your shimmy, Melanie. I'll wad it around his head."
Melanie's white face went crimson.
"Don't be silly. I won't look at you," said Scarlet. "If I had on a petticoat or pantalettes, I'd use them."
Crouching back against the wall, Melanie pulled the ragged linen garment over her head and silently tossed it to Scarlet, shielding herself as best she could with her arms.
"Thank God I'm not that modest," thought Scarlet, feeling rather than seeing Melanie's agony of embarrassment,
as she wrapped the ragged cloth about the shattered face. By a series of limping jerks, she pulled the body down the hall toward the back porch, and pausing to wipe her forehead with the back of her hand, glanced back toward Melanie, sitting against the wall, hugging her thin knees to her bare breasts.
How silly of Melanie to be bothering about modesty at a time like this, Scarlet thought irritably. It was just part of her nicey-nice way of acting which had always made Scarlet despise her.
Then shame rose in her.
After all, Melanie had dragged herself from bed so soon after having a baby, and had come to her aid with a weapon too heavy even for her to lift. That had taken courage, the kind of courage Scarlet honestly knew she herself did not possess. The thin steel, spun silk courage which had characterized Melanie on the terrible night at Lantafell and on the long trip home. It was the same intangible, unspectacular courage that all the Wilkeses possessed. A quality which Scarlet did not understand, but to which she gave grudging tribute.
"Go back to bed," she threw over her shoulder.
"You'll be dead if you don't. I'll clean up the mess after I've buried him."
"I'll do it with one of the rag rugs," whispered Melanie, looking at the pool of blood with a sick face.
"Well, kill yourself then and see if I care. And if any of the folks come back before I'm finished, keep them in the house and tell them the horse just walked in from nowhere."
Melanie sat shivering in the morning sunlight and covered her ears against the sickening series of thuds as the dead man's head bumped down the porch steps. No one questioned whence the horse had come. It was so obvious he was astray from the recent battle, and they were well pleased to have him. The Yankee lay in the shallow pit Scarlet had scraped out under the Scuppernong arbor. The uprights, which held the thick vines, were rotten, and that night Scarlet hacked at them with a kitchen knife until they fell and the tangled mass ran wild over the grave. The replacing of these posts was one bit of repair work Scarlet did not suggest, and if the Negroes knew why, they kept their silence. No ghost rose from that shallow grave to haunt her in the long nights when she lay awake, too tired to sleep. No feeling of horror or remorse assailed her at the memory. She wondered why, knowing that even a month before she could never have done the deed.
Pretty young Mrs. Hamilton, with her dimple and her jingling earbobs and her helpless little ways, blowing a man's face to a pulp and then burying him in a hastily scratched-out hole.
Scarlet grinned a little grimly, thinking of the consternation such an idea would bring to those who knew her.
"I won't think about it any more," she decided. "It's over and done with. And I'd have been a ninny not to kill him. I reckon I must have changed a little since coming home, or else I couldn't have done it."
She did not think of it consciously. But in the back of her mind, whenever she was confronted by an unpleasant and difficult task, the idea lurked, giving her strength. I've done murder, and so I can surely do this. She had changed more than she knew. And the shell of hardness which had begun to form about her heart when she lay in the slave garden at Twelve Oaks was slowly thickening. Now that she had a horse, Scarlet could find out for herself what had happened to her neighbors. Since she came home, she had wondered despairingly 1,000 times, "Are we the only folks left in the county? Has everybody else been burned out? Have they all refugeed to Macon?" With the memory of the ruins of Twelve Oaks, the McIntosh place, and the Slattery shack fresh in her mind, she almost dreaded to discover the truth. But it was better to know the worst than to wonder. She decided to ride to the Fontaines first, not because they were the nearest neighbors, but because old Dr. Fontaine might be there. Melanie needed a doctor. She wasn't recovering as she should, and Scarlet was frightened by her white weakness. So on the first day, when her foot had healed enough to stand a slipper, she mounted the Yankee's horse. One foot in the shortened stirrup, and the other leg crooked about the pommel in an approximation of a side saddle, she set out across the fields toward Mimosa, steeling herself to find it burned. To her surprise and pleasure, she saw the faded yellow stucco house standing amid the mimosa trees, looking as it had always looked. Warm happiness, happiness that almost brought tears, flooded her when the three Fontaine women came out of the house to welcome her with kisses and cries of joy. But when the first exclamations of affectionate greeting were over, and they had all trooped into the dining room to sit down, Scarlet felt a chill. The Yankees hadn't reached Mimosa because it was far off the main road. And so the Fontaines still had their stock and their provisions. But Mimosa was held by the same strange silence that hung over Terra, over the whole countryside. All the slaves, except 4 women house servants, had run away, frightened by the approach of the Yankees. There was not a man on the place, unless Sally's little boy Joe, hardly out of diapers, could be counted as a man. Alone in the big house were Grandma Fontaine, in her 70s, her daughter-in-law, who would always be known as Young Miss, though she was in her 50s, and Sally, who had barely turned 20. They were far away from neighbors and unprotected, but if they were afraid, it didn't show on their faces. Probably, thought Scarlet, because Sally and Young Miss were too afraid of the porcelain frail but indomitable old grandma to dare voice any qualms. Scarlet herself was afraid of the old lady, for she had sharp eyes and a sharper tongue, and Scarlet had felt them both in the past. Though unrelated by blood and far apart in age, there was a kinship of spirit and experience binding these women together. All 3 wore home-dyed mourning. All were worn, sad, worried. All bitter with a bitterness that did not sulk or complain, but nevertheless peered out from behind their smiles and their words of welcome. For their slaves were gone. Their money was worthless. Sally's husband, Joe, had died at Gettysburg, and Young Miss was also a widow. For young Dr. Fontaine had died of dysentery at Vicksburg. The other 2 boys, Alex and Tony, were somewhere in Virginia, and nobody knew whether they were alive or dead. And old Dr. Fontaine was off somewhere with Wheeler's cavalry. And the old fool is 73 years old, though he tries to act younger, and he's as full of rheumatism as a hog is of fleas, said Grandma, proud of her husband, the light in her eyes belying her sharp words. "Have you all had any news of what's been happening in Atlanta?" asked Scarlet, when they were comfortably settled. "We are completely buried at Terra."
"Law, child," said Old Miss, taking charge of the conversation, as was her habit. We're in the same fix as you are. We don't know a thing except that Sherman finally got the town.
So he did get it. What's he doing now? Where's the fighting now?
And how would three lone women out here in the country know about the war when we haven't seen a letter or a newspaper in weeks? Said the old lady tartly. One of our darkies talked to a darky who'd seen a darky who'd been to Jonesboro. And except for that, we haven't heard anything. What they said was that the Yankees were just squatting in Atlanta, resting up their men and their horses. But whether it's true or not, you're as good a judge as I am. Not that they wouldn't need a rest after the fight we gave them.
To think you've been at Terra all this time and we didn't know, young miss broke in. Oh, how I blame myself for not riding over to see. But there's been so much to do here, with most all the darkies gone, that I just couldn't get away. But I should have made time to go. It wasn't neighborly of me. But, of course, we thought the Yankees had burned Terra like they did 12 Oaks in the McIntosh house, and that your folks had gone to Macon. And we never dreamed you were home, Scarlet.
Well, how were we to know different when Mr. O'Hara's darkies came through here so scared they were pop-eyed and told us the Yankees were going to burn Terra? Grandma interrupted.
And we could see, Sally began.
I'm telling this, please, said old Miss shortly. And they said the Yankees were camped all over Terra, and your folks were fixing to go to Macon. And then that night we saw the glare of fire over toward Terra, and it lasted for hours, and it scared our fool darkies so bad they all ran off. What burned?
All our cotton. $150,000 worth, said Scarlet bitterly.
Be thankful it wasn't your house, said Grandma, leaning her chin on her cane. You can always grow more cotton, and you can't grow a house. By the by, had you all started picking your cotton?
No,
said Scarlet. And now most of it is ruined. I don't imagine there's more than 3 bales left standing in the far field in the creek bottom. And what earthly good will it do? All our field hands are gone, and there's nobody to pick it.
Mercy me! All our field hands are gone, and there's nobody to pick it, mimicked Grandma, and bent a satiric glance on Scarlet.
What's wrong with your own pretty paws, miss, and those of your sisters?
Me? Pick cotton? Cried Scarlet, aghast, as if Grandma had been suggesting some repulsive crime. Like a field hand? Like white trash? Like the Slattery women?
White trash, indeed. Well, isn't this generation soft and ladylike? Let me tell you, miss, when I was a girl, my father lost all his money, and I wasn't above doing honest work with my hands and in the fields, too, till Pa got enough money to buy some more darkies. I've hoed my row, and I've picked my cotton, and I can do it again if I have to. And it looks like I'll have to. White trash, indeed.
Oh, but Mama Fontaine, cried her daughter-in-law, casting imploring glances at the two girls, urging them to help her smooth the old lady's feathers. That was so long ago, a different day entirely, and times have changed.
Times never change when there's a need for honest work to be done, stated the sharp-eyed old lady, refusing to be soothed. And I'm ashamed for your mother, Scarlet, to hear you stand there and talk as though honest work made white trash out of nice people. When Adam delved and Eve span.
To change the subject, Scarlet hastily questioned. What about the Tarltons and the Calverts? Were they burned out? Have they refugeed to Macon?
The Yankees never got to the Tarltons. They're off the main road like we are. But they did get to the Calverts, and they stole all their stock and poultry and got all the darkies to run off with them.
Sally began.
Grandma interrupted. Ha! They promised all the black wenches silk dresses and gold earbobs. That's what they did. And Kathleen Calvert said some of the troopers went off with the black fools behind them on their saddles. Well, all they'll get will be yellow babies, and I can't say that Yankee blood will improve the stock.
Oh, Mama Fontaine!
Don't pull such a shocked face, Jane.
We're all married, aren't we? And God knows we've seen mulatto babies before this.
Why didn't they burn the Calvert's house?
The house was saved by the combined accents of the second Mrs. Calvert and that Yankee overseer of hers, Hilton.
Said old miss, who always referred to the ex-governess as the second Mrs. Calvert, although the first Mrs. Calvert had been dead 20 years.
"We are staunch Union sympathizers," mimicked the old lady, twanging the words through her long, thin nose. "Kathleen said the two of them swore up hill and down dale that the whole parcel of Calverts were Yankees. And Mr. Calvert dead in the wilderness. And Rayford at Gettysburg and Cade in Virginia with the army. Kathleen was so mortified, she said she'd rather the house had been burned. She said Cade would bust when he came home and heard about it. But then, that's what a man gets for marrying a Yankee woman. No pride, no decency, always thinking about their own skins.
How come they didn't burn Tara, Scarlet?" For a moment, Scarlet paused before answering. She knew the very next question would be, "And how are all your folks? And how is your dear mother?" She knew she couldn't tell them Ellen was dead. She knew that if she spoke those words, or even let herself think of them in the presence of these sympathetic women, she would burst into a storm of tears and cry until she was sick. And she could not let herself cry. She had not really cried since she came home, and she knew that if she once let down the floodgates, her closely husbanded courage would all be gone. But she knew, too, looking with confusion at the friendly faces about her, that if she withheld the news of Ellen's death, the Fontaines would never forgive her. Grandma, in particular, was devoted to Ellen, and there were very few people in the county for whom the old lady gave a snap of her skinny fingers.
"Well, speak up," said Grandma, looking sharply at her. "Don't you know, miss?"
"Well, you see, I didn't get home till the day after the battle," she answered hastily. "The Yankees were all gone then. Pa told me that he got them not to burn the house because Sue Ellen and Corinne were so ill with typhoid they couldn't be moved."
"That's the first time I ever heard of a Yankee doing a decent thing," said Grandma, as if she regretted hearing anything good about the invaders. "And how are the girls now?"
"Oh, they are much better, much better. Almost well, but quite weak," answered Scarlet. Then, seeing the question she feared hovering on the old lady's lips, she cast hastily about for some other topic of conversation. I wonder if you could lend us something to eat. The Yankees cleaned us out like a swarm of locusts. But if you are short on rations, just tell me so plainly, and—"
"Send over pork with a wagon, and you shall have half of what we've got. Rice, meal, ham, some chickens," said old miss, giving Scarlet a sudden keen look.
"Oh, that's too much, really.
Not a word. I won't hear it. What are neighbors for?"
"You are so kind that I can't... But I have to be going now. The folks at home will be worrying about me." Grandma rose abruptly and took Scarlet by the arm.
"You two stay here,"
she commanded, pushing Scarlet toward the back porch.
"I have a private word for this child. Help me down the steps, Scarlet."
Young Miss and Sally said goodbye and promised to come calling soon. They were devoured by curiosity as to what Grandma had to say to Scarlet, but unless she chose to tell them, they would never know. "Old ladies were so difficult," young Miss whispered to Sally as they went back to their sewing. Scarlet stood with her hand on the horse's bridle, a dull feeling at her heart. "Now," said Grandma, peering into her face,
"what's wrong at Tara? What are you keeping back?"
Scarlet looked up into the keen old eyes and knew she could tell the truth without tears. No one could cry in the presence of Grandma Fontaine without her express permission. "Mother is dead," she said flatly. The hand on her arm tightened until it pinched,
and the wrinkled lids over the yellow eyes blinked.
Did the Yankees kill her?
She died of typhoid. Died the day before I came home.
Don't think about it,
said Grandma sternly, and Scarlett saw her swallow.
And your pa?
Pa is not himself.
What do you mean? Speak up. Is he ill?
The shock. He is so strange. He is not...
Don't tell me he's not himself. Do you mean his mind is unhinged?
It was a relief to hear the truth put so boldly. How good the old lady was to offer no sympathy that would make her cry.
Yes, she said dully.
He's lost his mind. He acts dazed, and sometimes he can't seem to remember that Mother is dead. Oh, old miss, it's more than I can stand to see him sit by the hour waiting for her, and so patiently, too. And he used to have no more patience than a child. But it's worse when he does remember that she's gone. Every now and then, after he's sat still with his ear cocked, listening for her, he jumps up suddenly and stumps out of the house and down to the burying ground. And then he comes dragging back with the tears all over his face, and he says over and over till I can scream, Katie Scarlett, Mrs. O'Hara is dead. Your mother is dead. And it's just like I was hearing it again for the first time. And sometimes, late at night, I hear him calling her, and I get out of bed and go to him and tell him she's down at the quarters with a sick darky. And he fusses because she's always tiring herself out nursing people. And it's so hard to get him back to bed. He's like a child. Oh, I wish Dr. Fontaine was here. I know he could do something for Pa. And Melanie needs a doctor, too. She isn't getting over her baby like she should.
Melly? A baby? And she's with you?
Yes.
What's Melly doing with you? Why isn't she in Macon with her aunt and her kinfolks? I never thought you liked her any too well, miss, for all she was Charles's sister. Now tell me all about it.
It's a long story, old miss. Don't you want to go back in the house and sit down?
I can stand, said Grandma shortly. And if you told your story in front of the others, they'd be bawling and making you feel sorry for yourself. Now let's have it.
Scarlett began haltingly, with the siege and Melanie's condition. But as her story progressed, beneath the sharp old eyes which never faltered in their gaze, she found words. Words of power and horror. It all came back to her. The sickeningly hot day of the baby's birth. The agony of fear. The flight and Rhett's desertion. She spoke of the wild darkness of the night, the blazing campfires which might be friends or foes, the gaunt chimneys which met her gaze in the morning sun, the dead men and horses along the road, the hunger, the desolation, the fear that Tara had been burned. I thought if I could just get home to Mother, she could manage everything and I could lay down the weary load. On the way home, I thought the worst had already happened to me. But when I knew she was dead, I knew what the worst really was. She dropped her eyes to the ground and waited for Grandma to speak. The silence was so prolonged, she wondered if Grandma could have failed to comprehend her desperate plight. Finally, the old voice spoke, and her tones were kind, kinder than Scarlett had ever heard her use in addressing anyone.
Child, it's a very bad thing for a woman to face the worst that can happen to her. Because after she's faced the worst, she can't ever really fear anything again. And it's very bad for a woman not to be afraid of something. You think I don't understand what you've told me, what you've been through? Well, I understand very well. When I was about your age, I was in the Creek Uprising, right after the Fort Mims massacre.
Yes, she said in a faraway voice.
Just about your age, for that was 50-odd years ago. And I managed to get into the bushes and hide, and I lay there, and saw our house burn, and I saw the Indians scalp my brothers and sisters. And I could only lie there and pray that the light of the flames wouldn't show up my hiding place. And they dragged Mother out and killed her about 20 feet from where I was lying. And scalped her, too. And ever so often one Indian would go back to her and sink his tomahawk into her skull again. I was my mother's pet, and I lay there and saw it all. And in the morning, I set out for the nearest settlement, and it was 30 miles away. It took me 3 days to get there, through the swamps and the Indians, and afterward they thought I'd lose my mind. That's where I met Dr. Fontaine. He looked after me. Ah, well, that's been 50 years ago, as I said. And since that time, I've never been afraid of anything or anybody because I'd known the worst that could happen to me. And that lack of fear has gotten me into a lot of trouble and cost me a lot of happiness. God intended women to be timid, frightened creatures. And there's something unnatural about a woman who isn't afraid. Scarlet always saves something to fear. Even as you save something to love. Her voice trailed off, and she stood silent, with eyes looking back over half a century to the day when she had been afraid. Scarlet moved impatiently. She had thought Grandma was going to understand and perhaps show her some way to solve her problems. But like all old people, she'd gotten to talking about things that happened before anyone was born. Things no one was interested in. Scarlet wished she had not confided in her. "Well, go home, child, or they'll be worrying about you," she said suddenly. "Send pork with the wagon this afternoon. And don't think you can lay down the load ever. Because you can't. I know." Indian summer lingered into November that year, and the warm days were bright days for those at Tara. The worst was over. They had a horse now, and they could ride instead of walk. They had fried eggs for breakfast and fried ham for supper to vary the monotony of the yams, peanuts, and dried apples. And on one festal occasion, they even had roast chicken. The old sow had finally been captured, and she and her brood rooted and grunted happily under the house where they were penned. Sometimes they squealed so loudly no one in the house could talk, but it was a pleasant sound. It meant fresh pork for the white folks, and chitlins for the Negroes when cold weather and hog-killing time should arrive. And it meant food for the winter for all. Scarlet's visit to the Fontaines had heartened her more than she realized. Just the knowledge that she had neighbors, that some of the family friends and old homes had survived, drove out the terrible loss and alone feeling which had oppressed her in her first weeks at Tara. And the Fontaines and Tarletons, whose plantations had not been in the path of the army, were most generous in sharing what little they had. It was the tradition of the county that neighbor helped neighbor, and they refused to accept a penny from Scarlet, telling her that she would do the same for them, and she could pay them back in kind next year when Tara was again producing. Scarlet now had food for her household. She had a horse. She had the money and jewelry taken from the Yankee straggler, and the greatest need was new clothing. She knew it would be risky business sending pork south to buy clothes, when the horse might be captured by either Yankees or Confederates. But at least she had the money with which to buy the clothes, a horse and wagon for the trip, and perhaps pork could make the trip without getting caught. Yes, the worst was over. Every morning when Scarlet arose, she thanked God for the pale blue sky and the warm sun. For each day of good weather put off the inevitable time when warm clothing would be needed.
and each warm day saw more and more cotton piling up in the empty slave quarters, the only storage place left on the plantation. There was more cotton in the fields than she or Pork had estimated, probably 4 bales, and soon the cabins would be full. Scarlet hadn't intended to do any cotton picking herself, even after Grandma Fontaine's tart remark. It was unthinkable that she, an O'Hara lady, now the mistress of Tara, should work in the fields. It put her on the same level with the snarly-haired Mrs. Slattery and Emmy. She had intended that the Negroes should do the field work while she and the convalescent girls attended to the house. But here she was confronted with a caste feeling even stronger than her own. Pork, Mammy, and Prissy set up outcries at the idea of working in the fields. They reiterated that they were house niggers, not field hands. Mammy, in particular, declared vehemently that she had never even been a yard nigger. She had been born in the Robillard great house, not in the quarters, and had been raised in old Mrs. Bedroom, sleeping on a pallet at the foot of a bed. Dilsey alone said nothing, and she fixed her Prissy with an unwinking eye that made her squirm. Scarlet refused to listen to the protests and drove them all into the cotton rows. But Mammy and Pork worked so slowly and with so many lamentations that Scarlet sent Mammy back to the kitchen to cook and Pork to the woods and the river with snares for rabbits and possums and lines for fish. Cotton picking was beneath Pork's dignity, but hunting and fishing were not. Scarlet next had tried her sisters and Melanie in the fields, but that had worked no better. Melanie had picked neatly, quickly, and willingly for an hour in the hot sun and then fainted quietly, and had to stay in bed for a week. Sue Ellen, sullen and tearful, pretended to faint too, but came back to